Good afternoon and welcome to the Clearview School for a celebration of the life of a good friend of ours, David Lewis Fisher. For those of you who aren't familiar seeing me without a guitar or a mandolin hanging around my neck, my name is Steve Trott, and thank you so much for coming today. Today is not an easy day. It's a hard day. Elaine has lost her husband. Casey and Charlie, their father. Joni, her big brother, and all of us, a genuine, true, and trusted friend. But it's time to begin to turn that page, and not just to mourn David's passing and what we've lost, but to begin to celebrate his life, his many accomplishments, and the great gifts that he gave to each one of us that we all carry forward with us into the future. For David was that kind of a giving person. And there's no better way to start a celebration like this than with a song when you have David in mind. So I'd like to call up Mr. Craig Morris, better known as Dr. Morris, a good friend of Elaine's all the way from medical school, and he's going to favor us with a selection. Craig?
Just the word Elaine and I go back a long way, and back to even singing during our residency for some of the patients and everything, and playing music together. This, however, is something she asked me to do, which is part of a traditional memorial service. And this is for David. Mm-hmm.
El molero comim shoko.
Many of you are members of David's family, immediate and extended, and we're very fortunate to have with us today another member of David's family, and we know that he was always on David's mind because we have a fiddler who plays with us with the Highwaymen every once in a while, whose name is Jeremy Gold. And one time when our Jeremy came on stage to play the fiddle, he was announced to everybody as Jeremy Stone. Well, today we have with us the real Jeremy Stone. Jeremy Stone, where are you? Right here. Come on up. And he'll tell you about his relationship with David.
If it's okay, I'll play first and then talk. That was a meditation from the opera Thais by Massenet, which was one of David's and Elaine's favorites. I'm deeply honored that Elaine has asked me to come today and play Dave's piano. at which I feel at home because I also grew up playing a Kanabi grand piano. And to share some thoughts about my own relationship with David and about the three chord, which we'll get to a little bit later. But in order to do this, we have to go back to 1961, of course, the summer that Michael Row the Boat Ashore soared to the top of the charts. And during that summer, I was a 12-year-old camper at Schwader Camp in the Colorado Rockies. I grew up in Denver. And by that time, I was already a serious classical piano student and also a less serious guitarist and song leader and song singer and folk song fan, having taken up the guitar at Schwader Camp a couple of years earlier. So that summer, of course, Dave instantly became my idol. And every time he picked up the guitar, I was glued to listening and watching and learning from him. And, of course, I learned a great deal, but the most central thing that I learned was how to use a three chord. Three chord is the chord, when you're playing a song in a major key, it's a minor chord built on the third degree of the scale. And this is the chord that, in my opinion, since then, has always been my opinion that this chord and its use had a lot to do with the success of the Highwaymen's recording of Michael. So because we had sung Michael Row the Boat Ashore for many years, and counselors played it on the guitar, and it was usually something like... Right? Not a hit record, probably. Then Dave came along, and the Highwaymen, and... That's the three chord. It tugs at the heartstrings, and I loved that. So, of course, I started doing the same thing on all the songs whenever I found a chance. So we had songs like, you may remember one or two of these. Or a Bob Dylan song. That was my folk singing career built on the three chord. When I was a freshman in college, actually at Yale in Dave's hometown, where we would be asked to harmonize chorales, I had a reputation among my classmates as the three chord kid because I would put three chords in these Baroque pieces. I actually got marked off a point by the teacher for doing it once, but I didn't really care, and that teacher didn't get tenure. So to move the story along, my own life trajectory was that I spent 20 years as an arranger and composer and pianist and conductor in New York mostly, somewhat in Los Angeles. And then in my 40s, I decided it was time to do something serious, so I went to graduate school to become a psychologist. Wound up doing my clinical training it's got to be part of the story. Wound up doing my clinical training at New York Hospital, Cornell University, now known as New York Presbyterian Hospital since they merged, in White Plains. During my postdoctoral fellowship, I specialized in assessing and treating kids with learning disabilities and ADHD. Now, you have to know that a commonly heard remark over at the Westchester Division is, I wish we could get this kid into a place like Clearview. Clearview is viewed with that kind of respect and reverence, certainly at our hospital. So I was familiar with the name, and on a couple of occasions, I tested youngsters who attended school here. And in the process of that, I had to speak to the medical director of the Clearview School, who turned out to be a Dr. Elaine Hagen. And I called her, we spoke. Had no idea that there was any connection between Elaine Hagen and the Highwaymen or Dave Fisher until the Highwaymen gave a benefit concert at the Clearview School. My wife, Susan, happened to see a poster for it, surprised me with tickets. And it was that evening in this room that I learned that this Dr. Hagen I'd been speaking with was actually Dave Fisher's wife. So it's an amazing full circle experience. And, of course, that night, just as decades earlier I hung on every note, of Dave and of the group. And we became groupies, so we've been to see the group every time they've performed in these environs. I do want to share that it was always clear to Susan and me the affection, the deep affection and love between these guys who, after all these years, were reuniting and playing and obviously communicating not only music but a great deal of love. Dave also made it clear on those occasions and on occasions when we spent some other time together of his deep love and affection and abiding love for Elaine. So I did want to include that in this story. So was discussing with Elaine what other piece I might play here, and I suggested The Great Gate of Kiev by Mussorgsky, which is the concluding piece of the suite Pictures at an Exhibition. Now, why this piece, aside from the fact that I happen to love it? But the fact is, it's loaded with three chords, unusually used three chords. And when the teacher at Yale freshman year marked me off a point on my assignment, I tried to argue it back by saying, well, what about Mussorgsky? He's got all of these three chords right in the middle of it. I didn't get the point, and neither did he, but... Anyway, so this is my final statement for Dave.
Thank you.
was wonderful, Jim. Jeremy Stone. Jeremy, that was wonderful. And I had forgotten that this was David's piano, that years ago he decided to donate it to the Clearview School. You know, he loved this place. He became involved through Elaine, of course, and he became very involved over the years. I was over here all the time, and it occupied a very, very important place in David's heart. So for you to come and play that piece on David's piano, Jeremy, that was very special. Thank you so much. Reflections. Joni, where are you? Come on up. David's little sister, not so little anymore. He spent a long time singing with Joni when they lived out in Los Angeles. And it's always or sometimes said that somebody sings like a bird. Well, frankly, I think any bird would be embarrassed to be compared with Joni because she is really a terrific singer, too. Joni. Just get this out of your way.
Okay, I've got my tissues here. So I've known David a really long time. You know, it's probably maybe a couple of you out there who knew him before he was 6 years old, because that's when I was born. I went to breakfast with Elaine and my husband John and daughter Emily the other day, and as I was reaching for the ketchup to put on my eggs, I said to Elaine, "David taught me to put ketchup on my eggs," and I thought there's so many ways that David has touched my life and changed my life. But the ketchup, I think, was a really important one. And this morning I had breakfast with Casey. Where are you, Casey? Casey's missing in action. There he is. He's back there. And guess what? Casey puts ketchup on his eggs as well. So it's being passed down. My daughter won't put ketchup on her eggs. So we always had music in our house. Full of show tunes and classical and opera. My mother made us watch operas every Sunday. We didn't like it, but we like it now. We're glad she did. We always sang in the car. The thing that I remember most was sitting around the piano and singing folk songs out of the Fireside Book of Folk Songs. And, of course, David had the best voice and was our center. But I think he got his love of folk music from sitting around our house playing. And anybody who came to our house always had to come and sing around the piano with us. So that's a treasured memory. When he was a little bit older, he went out and bought a record called The Unchained Melody, which is a very famous piece. He played it over and over and over and over. And he sang with it, and he sang really beautifully, better than the actual record. And I can't hear that record without thinking of David. I wanted to talk a little bit about the academics. This was the group that he was in when he was in high school. I was 10 years old, way younger than he was. I do remember they practiced at our house all the time, and when they performed, they had white suits, and the songs were real jazzy and fun, and I remember the songs. But what I remember most is that on Halloween, they were practicing at the house. I came home with my big bag of candy, and put it down and went to bed, and when I came down in the morning, they had emptied the whole thing in the living room, and the academics ate all of my Halloween candy. But I did go onto YouTube and listen to the academics sing Darla My Darlin' and Something Cool, and David had the lead on both of those. He was 17 years old. He sounded like an angel. He sounded, that sound of his voice was so clear and specific. I could always pick him out whenever he sang in a group, and it was just wonderful. I thought, oh, I'm going to cry when I hear those songs, but they're real jazzy and fun, and if you want to pick me up, go on YouTube and look up the academics. It was really fun. When David was in college, he came home for the summer, and he decided he was going to learn how to play the banjo, and he twanged that thing day and night, every day, all summer, and we thought we were all going to go crazy. And thank God that Steve Butts excelled at the banjo and that David didn't have to practice that anymore. We were fairly thrilled.
But my mother after that.
Thank you, Steve. David gave me my first guitar. He taught me how to play. And when I turned 16, he gave me my Sweet 16 present. It was his guitar that he used in The Highwaymen. It was a Guild guitar. It was all banged up and scratched, you know, from all the hard playing he had done. And I was just thrilled to get it. And it came in a hard case. I had a guitar, but it was in a soft case. It came in a hard case, and it had The Highwaymen stenciled across it. And boy, was I proud to carry that case around. I still have it, and it's still one of my prized possessions. And David and I performed together in the early 70s. We both went to California, and we sang together. And it was such a privilege to sing with him and perform with him on stage. He wrote all of our songs. He arranged them. He spent hours teaching me to do the harmony, because I'm not very good with harmony, and as my daughter knows, he had to work and be very patient with me to learn those harmonies, but I did, and it was the highlight of my life beside my family to be able to perform with David. David is always going to be in our hearts, and of course his music will always be here, and we'll always have that. And I can see in his son, Casey, his charm, his easy charm, and his wit. And I adore Casey. And his beautiful daughter, Charlie, has inherited his lovely voice. And when the Highwaymen sang at Charlie's school in California when she was in elementary school, I think it was at elementary school, David called Charlie up on stage, and they sang a song called Papa Was a Music Man, which was written by David and his partner, Wayne. And Charlie went up on stage, and I actually had never heard her sing before, and she sang beautifully. And her voice with David's voice was something to do with, you know, that he was her father and he gave her his genes, and their voices just blended so beautifully. I cried when she sang. And really, their father, Papa, was a music man. He spent his whole life writing and singing and bringing joy and pleasure to everybody. And I would just like to say, thank you, David. We had so much fun.
So many funny threads come together on a day like this. I am the culprit of ketchup on eggs, and I didn't know that it had gone down through the generations like that. But there's even another connection, because the time that I introduced David to ketchup on eggs was on his trip back from Colorado when he was Jeremy Stone's counselor. And instead of flying all the way back to the East Coast, he flew to Cincinnati. And David and I then drove from there, from Cincinnati, back to the East Coast to go to school. And that's when I introduced David to ketchup on eggs. So it's interesting to see how these funny things come together. You know, banjos are fascinating. I have a secretary named Tony. And when she found out we had a banjo in our group, she said, you know, when I was younger and I was going to go out on a date with somebody and I took a look at his clothes and I heard banjos, I was out of there. Next, we have Jed Burgess and his friend Becca, who are going to dance for us, and they're going to dance to a song called Angels in My Backyard. Angels in My Backyard was written by David and his collaborator. On the program, you see that the collaborator is named Clyde. Well, that's A.B. Clyde. Come on up. That's A.B. Clyde, better known as Wayne Hagstrom. And Wayne's here today, and he's going to sing for you in a few moments. But this was one of David and Wayne's songs, Angels in My Backyard.
As I wait for a break, guitar when they are signs that heaven is not very far. I see angels in my backyard. Watching through
Jed and Becca, thank you. There's no mistaking that voice, is there? It was unique. Not only was David an instinctive singer, but he had a quality to his voice that you knew in a moment that that was David's voice. It was phenomenal. Barry, are you here? Where are you? There he is. Come on up. David, as you know, grew up in New Haven. Joni? Oh, you want your tissues back. David grew up in New Haven with this man. He was one of David's best friends, and he's here from California. Barry Lonk, better known to David as the Lunk.
Well, David was the fish to many of us. I'd like to acknowledge, first of all, my good friends present here today and David's family, Elaine and Casey and Charlie and Joni family. Another fellow that we grew up with, Bill Polinsky's in the audience with his wife, Doris. The Highwaymen are here. I'm sure Wayne and Sharon are here, or Clyde. And other friends. David, in his own words, had a life of miracles. The beginning of his life was in a difficult time for people like me. David and his family were a safe harbor for me during years that were difficult, okay? I went to a play in Washington about a week ago. Lawrence Fishburne did a one-man play about Thurgood Marshall, which, of course, gave a historical perspective to the times that David and I and Polinsky were going through. Brown versus Board of Education took place in 1954. We had integrated schools in Connecticut and New Haven, but the housing was different. When I was visiting my sister recently in Washington, she reminded me that there was the white court and the black court. And there were several white courts and black courts. Bill Polinsky, at that point, lived up in the place where the whites lived. I lived where the blacks lived. Dave Fisher lived where the Jewish people lived. Now, you know, he cut through all that. He and his family, as well as Bill Polinsky's family, made it possible for me to have a good feeling about my community and the people around me. I would go to Dave's house, his wonderful mother, and his, you talk about a wry sense of humor, his dad. Oh, my God. He was so funny and interesting and so caring. So I'm here really to talk about Dave's humanity. Oh, man. You know, he's a singer. I guess you can be a singer without and a musician without having humanity. But I think it makes it a lot better, a lot richer, if you're a real mensch. And David was that. Because of Fish and Polinsky, I had a confidence in good people of all backgrounds. Fish would be in a situation with me where someone slighted me or did something because I was black. He'd use a wry sense of humor to just get through it. Hey, Long, don't worry about those, blah, 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 whatever. And it was like, he's my friend, but he's my guide. My guide through a society which at that time was a little bit scary, in a sense. In sports, when we were kids, Dave, he wasn't much of an athlete. When we played basketball after school in Jay Alpert's backyard, Dave would have a sort of sneaky jump shot. But he wouldn't dribble into the basket or anything like that. He loved sports. He played wiffle ball a lot with Bill and myself. I was a Dodger fan. He was a Phillies fan, sometimes St. Louis. I never knew why he picked those teams. I picked the Dodgers because they had Jackie Robinson. That was my team. And he understood that. They were tumultuous times. Now, the middle of our life together, whenever I heard the words, hey, Lunk, it was like music to my ears. It was like bringing back good memories. He might be in some place and he called me and say, hey, the Highwaymen are performing down in Charleston. You want to come? Whoa, Charleston, 1960-something. Whoa. Charleston was a beautiful city. I went because Dave asked me to, and I was able to get behind backstage and other things. The South was a difficult place for me. Dave made that particular occasion easy. In L.A., we had some great times. He and Wayne were collaborating in music. Every time something came up, Fish and I would talk the politics of it. I'd say he was sort of a little bit conservative compared to me, but he had humanity to go along with the conservatism. And so he had absolute love and pride in his kids when they came around. He was a compassionate human being. He wasn't necessarily that smart financially. I'm sure he did okay, but one day he said, Look, I'm going to go up to Reno and buy some land on Watermelon Mountain. Oh, yeah, where's that? Oh, yeah, boy, everyone in Hollywood is buying this land. Man, it's going to make us a fortune. So let's go up there, Fish. So we took a flight up to Reno. The first taxi cab we got, we started talking about Watermelon Mountain. And the guy says, hey, I used to hunt up there. Ain't a drop of water in that barren patch of stuff. And so Fish decided not to invest in that one. After a while, we came to have a long-distance relationship. I went to Sacramento. He was in L.A. first and then in New York. And he as everyone said, loved Elaine, and I talked to him through his illness. We kept talking about our mutual illnesses, you know. So for the latter years, we were both sort of getting old, and we had our ailments. He took me to a play. We took a train down to off Broadway to see The Spelling Bee. And it was a great play. I walked in that place, someone grabbed me, "You're going to be on stage." And Fish couldn't have laughed harder. So I'm on the stage, and there's a part where I have to dance with people and stuff. And Fish, we cracked up about that. I've got credits on Broadway, right? The last time I saw him, we met in New Haven. He really went out of his way to see me. I'd come back for a funeral for Mrs. Jenkins, a matriarch 100 years old from New Haven, from the Black Courts. And he came up to see me and my sister. And he was really walking slowly, but the glint in his eye was fabulous still. And we spent a day, and that was a very precious day in my life. Near the end, I sent an email to Fish about a disabled boy who was able, because of the generosity of the other kids in an important game, to be able to score the winning run. The pitcher, even easy pitch, when he caught the ground ball back to me, threw it over the first baseman's head so this kid can run around the bases and score. And he was delighted, and the kid died that summer, but he had had his day in the sun. And that'll, we'll get to that shortly. I got word that Dave was in the hospice and got to speak to him twice. He still had continued dignity and wit. Now, this may be not true, but I heard this happen. Someone here can verify it. They started extolling Dave's virtues and saying he was a great guy and this stuff and that stuff. And the guy, Fish, looks up, "Hey, I'm not dead yet." Did that happen? Yeah. I think that's just like Fish. On May 7th, we heard the Fish had died. It was hard, even though I knew it was imminent. About 10 days later, going through my emails, I saw that Dave had returned my email. Now, how'd this happen? About the disabled boy. And I first noticed that at the very end of three pages about this kid, there was a note from Fish. "My dearest and oldest friends," to Bill Polinsky and myself, "my life, a rich and one full of miracles, seems to be coming to an end. More than likely, sooner than later, at home with a hospice visiting every day. Your lifetime friend, David." Hearing my friend after he died, what can I say? It was a miracle. Thank you.
Lunk, as we still call him, is a distinguished judge in Sacramento, California. And I remember when Barry's name first went up before the governor, David called me. I was in politics at the time and said, "We've got to help. What can we do to help Barry get on the bench?" You know what? He didn't need any help because he was who he is. And so he managed to. How long have you been a judge now, Barry? Still, yeah, that's great. He's had a great career. You know, about David as an athlete, I do have to tell you that even though he might not have been much of an athlete, he was the pitcher on our fraternity softball team in college. Now, you might take that as a measure of how good our softball team was, but I must tell you that we made it all the way to the championship game. We won all the games with David and Bruce Corwin pitching back and forth. And so in the championship game, David was chosen to pitch. It was a slow pitch game. And we got right down to the last out in the last inning. And if we're able to accomplish this out, our unbelievably bad team is the champions of Wesleyan University. So the batter's in the box. There's two down. This is the last batter. David throws him a nice soft pitch, and the batter weakly grounds it to David right at the pitcher's mound. All David has to do is throw it about from here to the microphones, and we win the championship. And so help me God, he fielded the ball and threw it right into the crowd. Bruce Corwin could have killed him, I have to tell you. But you know, in the end, it was much better that it happened that way because we didn't deserve to be in the championship game. And it makes a much better story to have it end that way than with some kind of a funny trophy. Oh, my goodness. A.B. Clyde, where are you? Better known as Wayne Hagstrom. I think you're up. Where's Wayne? There he is. Come on, get up here. David met Wayne, years ago now, and they were a perfect match. David had the three-chord musical talent, and Wayne had the words to go with it. And so together, they worked out all kinds of things. Why don't you go over there and get set up while I talk about it? Oh, you're going to talk first. Well, that's good. And many of you might remember, well, maybe I'll let him talk about it because he might bring it up. One of our favorite songs in our concerts for years has been a song that Wayne and David collaborated on. So, Wayne, it's all yours.
I met David a long time before, you know. Most people think I met him in 69. I met David in 57 or 58. He was with a group called the Academics. And they had a number of hits in New Haven and the Worcester area. And I was a big record fan in those days. I was about 10. In 57 or 58, they came to Worcester, the Academics, to do a concert. And they did it at a high school, which was right across the street from me. And I was just a little blonde kid about this high, but I was aware of the Academics, so I decided to go and try to sneak into the gym. This was a high school dance. And I was unable to get in, but I hung around outside. And during the break, the Academics came out. I think they had Something Cool was the hit. I had bought that record. And I was just a kid involved with rock and roll. And they came out, and I still remember they had the white sport coats on and the steam coming off them because they were having a break. And I was, I wanted to meet this group. So one of them walked down the stairs, and he got into a car with a girl. And the girl turned out to be David Fish's girlfriend, and that's the reason they were playing this high school right across the street from where I lived, because they usually didn't play Worcester, but they did this night because he was going with a girl from the school. So that was David walking into the car, and this was my chance, so I went up to the car, and I rapped on the window, and David, you know, he was making out there with his girlfriend. And he put the window down, and he said, "What do you want, kid?" And I started to tell him how much I liked his music. And he said, "Well, great, great, thanks." And he rolled the window back up, but I wasn't done, you know. So I rapped again. This, you couldn't write stuff like this. I mean, this is And he rolled the window down, and I started in again on how much I liked this song, Something Cool. And he said, "Hold it," he said, "here's a quarter." He said, "Would you please go away?" So I took the quarter, and I went away, and he rolled the window back up. We didn't realize that this had happened until we were in California for a while. And it came out that this happened. And he said, "Well, that was me. I was the one that went to the car. I remember the kid." So I was, you know, sure it was him, but years later I took him back to that alley next to the high school, and I wanted him to point out exactly where the car was, and he did. He said it was right at that spot, and it was him. So that was our first meeting, and then was a short meeting when he was in the Highwaymen, which I went to a concert. I went up and talked to him. We didn't realize it was the same guy in the car. And then that was it until I came out to California. We came out about the same time. And I ended up living right behind him, and we didn't know that we had met each other. He was just a guy that was on the in the yard reading a book, sitting down all the time. And for about the first 9 months, I just walked by him and said, "How you doing? Hi." And we didn't really know each other. And I don't know. David had a habit of, walking his dog, Sam. And I would see him walk the dog, and I still hadn't spoken to him very often. But I noticed twice he walked the dog. He was supposed to be walking the dog, but he was dragging the leash, and he didn't have a dog. So, and this caught my attention. So the third time that this happened, I went up to him. And wait, and I said, "What are you doing, Dave, you know?" And he says, "Well," he says, "I'm walking my dog." And I says, "Well, where's your dog?" And he looked back, and he just looked at me, and he goes, "Whoops." So right then and there, I said, "Well, this guy's going to be my buddy." So we actually started talking to each other then, but just a little bit. What really got us together, and Steve will attest to this, he probably remembers this incident. There was a guy, there was a bongo player for the Merv Griffin show, and he was living next to us. And he was about 45 years old, and about 6'4", about 245, big, rough, crazy guy, George. You remember him, Steve? Yeah. And I'll do this quickly. Johnny Rivers had given me this beautiful Gibson guitar, and I had a session coming up in a week, and I was supposed to bring this guitar to the session, and George came over and said, "You're bothering me." He opened the door, and he put his fist right through the Gibson guitar and just ruined it. And about a week later, George came back and got out of the car, and I was there, and Dave was out there. And he went up to Dave, he was drunk, and he went up to Dave and he says, "Here's $400 if you let me punch you, because I've never liked you." And me and a couple of other people were watching this, and Dave took the money. I couldn't believe it. He took the money, and George gave him a couple of good ones. And we ran out and we broke it up, we grabbed George. But, any fish had a shiner and a thing here, and everything was going pretty well, but then George took the money back. So he grabbed it, and Dave had to walk in, and this is how we got together, through this violent little episode that actually happened. So now we had something to talk about, and we started to become friends, and we wrote for the next 30 years together. We realized we were both in the music business. And we were best buddies out there, and he taught me a lot. I taught him. He taught me about politics, philosophy. I taught him about baseball and comedy. And we had a great relationship. And we went on for 30 years, and we wrote well over 1,000 songs together, well over 1,000 songs. Dave had a great melody sense. I'm going to. I was going to do 17 songs, but I was told I can do one. So I had to choose one here. So I'm going to do a song that I wrote 3 days ago about David and myself. We'll see if I can get through this. I don't know the lyric. I need that in too. I got one. I just need this probably set up over here. that over there.
You two wrote number one together, too,
didn't you? Oh, yeah. Yeah, this just kind of popped out, so I don't know the song, so I'm going to try to see if I can do it here. It was summer '69 when I met that pal of mine. He had a melody, I had a rhyme, and we were on our way. We wrote a record and it climbed the charts, then it fell off and it broke our hearts. But we had other songs to start, guitars to play. We took a cross-country trip, that old Vegas engine skipper. We made it out to the house where he lived when TV was black and white. We searched his attic for some baseball cards, but all we found was a metal car that he used to pedal around his yard. The kids still played outside. Friends stay when the going gets tough. Friends watch your back, they can't give you enough. Your car breaks down, they'll drive you home. They'll feed your dog when you leave them alone. Friends call when your birthday comes. You're short on cash, man, they'll give you some. They'll lighten your load. Friends will fix your broken road. Watching each other's children grow. Little League games and grammar school shows. On New Year's Eve we'd watch the ball drop. We'd solve the problems of the world in those little coffee shops. Friends stay when the going gets tough. Friends watch your back, they can't give you enough. Your car breaks down, they'll drive you home. They'll feed your dog when you leave them alone. Friends call when your birthday comes. You're short on cash, man, they'll give you some. They'll lighten your load. Friends will fix your broken road. They'll lighten your load. Friends will fix your broken road. Thanks. Okay, thanks.
Great job, man. Very nice. Take a breath. I I think you can see and hear why David and Wayne enjoyed each other's company, musical and as well as personal. And David and Wayne wrote Number One, which is the song I was referring to. It's a long way down from Number One, which was one of our concert favorites over the years. David was certainly the heart of the Highwaymen. He was always our musical director. But the soul of the Highwaymen has always been Steve Butts.
It's been 5 weeks since David left us. Time for the thousands of memories to organize themselves into recent and long ago, into trivial and profound. I'd like to share with you today a couple of the more profound memories that have popped up in my mind in the last few weeks. First of all, because they're important to me, but I think there are so many people who knew David well in this room that they might well be important to you as well. In any case, they tell the kind of person that David was and why we loved him so. The thing I remember most standing here about David was the generosity of his friendship. David was not friends with everyone, but if he was friends with you, his friendship was deep, it was lasting, it was unlimited, and above all, it was unconditional. He had a way, a knack of looking into a person beyond the externals, into where a person really lived. And he was not always right, but he did use that to decide whether he would be friends with that person. And that friendship lasted a long time. 15 or 20 years ago, when he was in the music business in Los Angeles, he was awakened one night by a phone call at 3 a.m. from, of all people, Paul McCartney of the Beatles. He didn't know Paul McCartney. He'd never met him. But Paul had heard that David knew a third guy, someone who was in the music business, producer, director, something like that. And Paul said, you David Fisher? He said, yes. He said, I'm Paul McCartney. I need so-and-so's number. And David waited just a second. He said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. You give me your number, and I'll call him, and he'll call you back. It's 3 a.m., okay? And McCartney got real uptight. He said, do you know who I am? Who the hell are you? And a string of curse words. David took the phone and hung it up. Went back to bed. Not too many people in the music business hang up on Paul McCartney. David did, because David's friend was David's friend, and Paul McCartney was not a friend. It was that simple. No thinking, no second thoughts. I remember as well, far before that, in the winter of 1959, we were all freshmen at Wesleyan University. It was a cold February day, and it had been snowing, and I was walking back to the fraternity house after my 11 o'clock class to go to lunch, and as I came up on the fraternity house in the front yard, there was a snowball fight going on, four or five or six, and there was Dave Fisher standing between me and the door with a big grapefruit-sized slush ball in his hand. And David looked at me. He said, you think because you're crippled, I won't throw this at you. And I said, "Well, not really. I just had the bam right in the kisser. Down I go into the slush and the mush, and I'm cold and I'm wet. And I look up, and there's Dave Fisher, laughing, enjoying himself, looking beyond the externals into treating me like everyone else. I will treasure that." Another thing that was generous about David was he was so generous with music itself. A lot of musicians, and some of the more mediocre ones, have one or two little tricky things that they do that they feel makes their career. And they don't share that. They don't. If you ask them how they do it, they don't tell you, because they're fearful that somehow you will take it away from them. That was the opposite of what David Fisher was with music. He gave music to everyone. He gave his music to professionals. He gave it to amateurs. He gave it to fans. He gave it to people on the street. He would prefer to get paid for it, but he would also give it out for nothing. And he did for years and years. I remember, it's hard to explain to people for whom this has not happened, but if you're on stage playing music or dancing or even acting with somebody in front of an audience who's really good, it's a transcendent experience. It's a joyful. It takes you out of yourself. You become better than you possibly could be. And that happened so many times with David. I remember time after time, we'd be singing a song that we've done 100 times. And it was going well. The song was great. We were in contact with the audience. They were enjoying it. And all of a sudden, out of nowhere, David comes up with something brand new, a new chord, a new harmony, something vocal, a little thing on the guitar. And I'm just stunned, because it's so natural, it's so different, and it's so exactly right. And he makes the song. He lifts the song up into a new level by doing that. It's just a miracle. I don't think David's music was in his head. I think David's music was in his hands and in his voice, because he was just so natural about it. And of course, there were those far fewer times when David would be playing and one of us would come up with something that made sense or was a little unusual, or we happened to play a difficult part particularly well that night. And we look over, and David would have this great smile on his face, just exactly like this. He would be smiling as if to say, "Hey, that was great. Do it again. That was wonderful." And so he was just so generous with both giving his music and giving us our space to create our own music. Well, it's time to say goodbye. It's time to have the memories play out and to say, "David, Javier, old friend, farewell. Thank you for enriching our lives."